This week, it's the third and final tidbit from the Coin Jar. It's a selection I call The First Slow Dance. It's autobiographical, to a certain extent, about a date, actually more of a meetup, as you'd call it these years, which happened 50 years ago this month. Needless to say, most of the names have been changed to protect the innocent. The story may run a little longer than usual. First run at it ran a little over 30 minutes, so plan your listening accordingly. From the Coin Jar, The First Slow Dance, a short story. I was, with little doubt, the biggest nerd in this group of kids inhabiting our immediate neighborhood who walked to and from Miller Hansen Junior High School. I attended the school for the 7th and most of the 8th grade. Despite being a nerd, I was the first in that immediate group to actually slow dance with a girl. It happened at our 7th grade party, and boy were some of my friends surprised. When we first became junior high students, we had a number of challenges presented to us when we stepped into the MHJHS campus of September of 1967. The first challenge was survival. Just 3 months earlier, when we left D.B. Terrell Elementary School, we were the kings. We'd survived 7 years of elementary school and now found ourselves knocked back to the bottom of the heap, subservient to the 8th and 9th graders who reminded us daily of their superiority with every bit of disdain that they could muster. They reasoned that they suffered in their own debut at MHJHS. Why should our incoming class be any different? Mere survival was complicated by having to mingle with kids from two other elementary schools. This new mingling did have some advantages in that I was able to expand my circle of friends beyond Louis Fetzer and the kids in my immediate neighborhood. My mother encouraged my friendship with Fetzer because I had more in common with him than I had with the kids that I grew up with. Not long after we met in the third grade, I found that my boundaries had been expanded. I was no longer restricted to my views, and no longer restricted to my side of my neighborhood for playmates. Fetzer and I were both part of the cello section of the school orchestra, along with Beth Carnahan and Buddy Lawson. Beth and Buddy were not very happy with the fact that I was a better player than either of them. Beth was especially put out that she didn't get her first chair like she thought she was supposed to, being in the 9th grade and all, you see. She was downright mad that I, as a 7th grader, could play rings around her. Every 2 weeks she would challenge me. Every 2 weeks Mr. Ludwig would sit us down, give us a piece of music, and make us play. Every 2 weeks Beth would somehow become flustered, and every 2 weeks I got to keep my chair in the cello section of the school orchestra. Lawson was cool with the way things were. He was okay with being third chair. The fact that Carnahan got so bent out of shape by not being the first chair cello amused him. He was an 8th grader who had a full year of listening to her brag about how she was going to be first chair the next year when David Childs went to high school. Mr. Ludwig let it be known that while Childs was a good player, I was still better. He was looking forward to my being in the 9th grade so that I could be counted as being in high school to give him an edge for the spring music contests. My concerns extended beyond my status in the school orchestra. My voice was beginning to drop, and I was starting to show other signs of my impending battle with puberty. Those afflictions were predicted a year and a half earlier when the school district invited boys and their fathers to a special meeting to have the birds and the bees talk. Before the talk, the guys in the neighborhood took great interest in what their older sisters were going through as they were hitting puberty. Gary Bungard went so far as to steal several of his sister's tampons, tie them to arrows, soak them with gasoline, and then launch them in the direction of the interstate highway which had just been built. The arrows were lit when they were launched, of course. That enterprise was shut down by the State Highway Patrol when one of the flaming arrows actually made it up to the roadway. Bungard ended up being grounded for a month. Most of the other boys were showing signs of their impending adulthood, too, a fact celebrated in the communal shower after gym class. Another first for us 7th grade boys, by several smart alecks bragging about having to wash their hair. Seventh grade boys can be gross and disgusting. The girls were dealing with their own issues. Their bodies were changing, and we were noticing. Breasts were beginning to appear behind the various shirts, dresses, and sweaters that they wore. There is speculation among us guys as to which girls may or may not have been supplanting their developing forms by the prudent use of facial tissue. Some of the girls were obviously faking. Sally Hinckley, for instance, was known to have the occasional bit of tissue sticking out of her bra, which was too big for her. She wasn't the only seventh grade girl who did the same thing, but since she was considered to be one of the prettiest girls in our class, the few faults she had were amplified at the worst possible times. Her mother made up for Sally's relatively flat chest by dressing her in clothes which helped to emphasize what she didn't have. Her parents parked their late model Cadillacs in front of their house to add to the illusion that Sally was somehow desirable despite her lack of development. The guys in my neighborhood who walked by the Hinckley house on the way to and from school fell for the ruse. It was generally agreed by most of us that Sally was the ideal seventh grade girl, in spite of the occasional bit of tissue paper tucked under her bra. As desirable as Sally Hinckley was to most of the seventh grade boys, Diane Sims wasn't. Diane was just another nerd in orchestra. She played the violin, first violin, second chair, wore cat-eye glasses, and had a mouthful of metal braces when she arrived at MHJHS in September with the rest of us. She wasn't worth a second look as far as my neighborhood group was concerned. She was seen as a geek, someone who'd always be a geek, and was, therefore, someone very few of the boys wanted to have anything to do with. I talked with her from time to time. Our talks are mostly short grunts of hello back in the room where we stored our instruments after orchestra rehearsal. As the school year progressed, our talks became just a little longer, but still, there was nothing extraordinary in our conversations. Had it not been for several changes after we came back from Christmas vacation, the conversations Diane and I had might have reached a limit of roughly 3 minutes by the end of the school year. When everyone returned from Christmas vacation, the first thing everyone noticed was that Diane looked different than she did just 3 weeks earlier. The cat-eye glasses were gone, as were the braces. The girl in the second chair of the first violin section was the same, but she was different. Her new outward appearance made her look interesting. There was also a change in our PE class. In the first week of January, we were told to come to PE in our regular clothes the next week, although we were still expected to wear our gym shoes. The rumor was that we were going to learn how to square dance with girls. Since the middle of October, the curtains separating the boys' half of the gym from the girls' half of the gym had been pushed aside in order to accommodate basketball games. When the curtain was pushed aside, there was an invisible line which kept the genders apart. Now that line was going to be compromised. We were going to be thrown together so that we could learn to do something none of us, well, at least me, had ever heard of before. Before we made it to our next PE class, the posters went up. There's going to be a party. It would be the seventh grade party held at the end of February. There would be food and music and dancing with girls. None of the boys in the seventh grade were sure about the protocol one had to observe in regard to girls. It was bad enough that we were going to have to mix with them in PE class, but the powers running the school decided that we needed to continue that mixing after school in an appropriate fashion. The guys in my neighborhood had it all figured out. Tom Kramer, the Streeny boys, and Bungard all had older sisters, and the sisters had boyfriends. The summer before, we watched, at a discreet distance, as the boyfriends cuddled up next to the big sisters, stealing kisses and putting their hands in places that none of us would dare put our hands on if we happened to be a girl, or with a girl. There was wild speculation about what went on between the big sisters and their boyfriends once they were able to be rid of us. We were definitely undecided as to whether or not we wanted to see what was going on. Eventually, the sisters and their boyfriends let us know that our attention to their comings and goings were not appreciated. In other words, we were told to get lost. Bungard was the only one of us who paid a little attention to what his sisters told him. He became a peeping Tom, regaling us with tales of what he supposedly saw with us sneaking around. Our pending interactions with girls had most of us scared. The girls didn't seem scared in the least, something I found out the first day that we paired off in PE to learn square dancing. As it turned out, I was paired with Diane. Opposite us were Fetzer and Debbie Hale, one of the flute players in the orchestra. As it turned out, Debbie was Diane's best friend. Sally Hinckley was in the square as my corner, and her best friend, Linda Walcott, was Fetzer's corner. Fetzer and I managed to make it through the first square dance lesson with little problem until we arrived in orchestra at the end of the day. While we were preparing our instruments for rehearsal, Fetzer pulled me aside to ask me what I thought about the dance lesson. I glanced over to see Diane and Debbie off to the other side of the storage room whispering to each other. There's little doubt that Fetzer and I were the topic of their conversation. At the end of rehearsal, I found myself having my usual post-rehearsal conversation with Diane. There wasn't much said, as usual, but she seemed to be more interested in me than she was before. Something inside of me told me that maybe I should take Diane out to the seventh grade party. Instead of taking the direct way home that afternoon, I decided to walk home with Fetzer. We headed to his house at our usual pace, unusually quiet for the both of us. It wasn't until we were almost at his house before the subject of the party came up to conversation. He actually opened up our discussion by asking if I intended to ask Diane to go to the seventh grade party with me. I asked him if he thought I should. He told me that he thought it would be a good idea. At that point in my life, I wasn't sure whether or not it would be a good idea to ask a girl to a social function. It would be a date, and dates were for teenagers, older teenagers in the order of being 16 or 17. I was only 12. Yes, I would turn 13 by the day of the party, but I still wasn't going to consider myself as being a teenager. Then there's the basic mystery of girls to begin with. Our interactions with them, other than with our sisters, were a whole lot simpler before we had the talk. It seemed as if they had their own version of the talk, one which seemed to open their minds to possibilities they had never considered before, like kissing. Almost exactly a year before we learned about the impending seventh grade party, a girl named Pamela lured me into a corner of the playground at our elementary school and asked me to give her a first boy-girl kiss. She pointed out that her family was moving away after she had finished the sixth grade. I consented. No one would know. Sally Hinckley made some sort of reference to my kiss with Pamela on the last day of the sixth grade, but whatever she said was forgotten by the time we first set foot in junior high school. So here I was, walking with Fetzer back to his house, and he was asking me if I was going to be asking Diane to go to the party with me. I froze. I wasn't against it, but I wasn't not really all for doing it either. I let Fetzer know that I wasn't sure. I told him that I would make my decision in a day or two. The alone part of the walk home from school was spent contemplating what I should do. Word of the impending party reached my mother's ears before I had a chance to get out or get home that afternoon. Minutes after walking in the door, she asked about the party and asked if I had plans to attend. Of course I was going to attend. Did I intend to take a date? Her question made my mind up that I was going to ask Diane to attend the party with me, but I was not going to tell my mother. There would be questions about my intentions and about who this girl was that I was going to take to the party. I didn't know enough about Diane to tell her. Considering what happened with Doreen Capoul last summer, I didn't care to answer those questions. Now, Doreen stole her first kiss with a boy from me under the watchful eyes of her parents in her backyard. Her family and our family attended the same church. She took a fancy to me with the blessings of both sets of parents, so we spent time together. Her father was enthusiastic about the matchup. I came to the conclusion that somehow he had missed early puberty and had no idea how nasty boys could be between the sixth and seventh grade. My father must have sensed my lack of enthusiasm for Doreen's advances. He kept whatever comments he may have had to himself. I learned later that he'd been there, pushed off onto an over-eager girl, thankfully not my mother, at a young age. My mother, on the other hand, wanted to know every juicy detail of what happened every time Doreen and I spent an afternoon together. I found ways of deflecting my mother's inquisition about the party before slipping back outside to encounter the peers in my neighborhood. Kramer was waiting for me outside. The first thing he wanted to know was whether or not I intended to take Sally to the party with me. He reasoned that someone had to take her, and since she was nearly my partner in our little square dance group, I would be the most likely of our little neighborhood group to take her. I told him I wasn't thinking about taking anyone. He was good with my decision. He assumed that I was at least not going to take Diane. He knew that she and I were square dance partners, and he offered his condolences. We went over to Bungard's for a while. He asked the same thing about the party. I told him the same thing that I told Kramer. Then came the dare. Bungard dared me to ask Sally to the party so that I could slow dance with her. I knew where the dare was headed. He wanted me to figure out whether or not Sally was actually using tissue to emphasize what she hadn't yet developed. I told Gary that I would see what I could do. For the next week, I walked home with Fetzer every day. If I walked the direct route back home, I would most certainly encounter Sally. I wanted to avoid her so that I could honestly tell Bungard that I hadn't had a chance to ask her to the party. If I walked home with Fetzer, though, there was a chance that I could end up walking with Diane. I didn't feel that I was ready to do that. I wanted to ask her to the party, but I wasn't ready to ask her either. So for most of the next 2 weeks, Fetzer bolstered my courage on our walks home. "She has a notebook into which she has written your name at least 1,000 times, Fetzer lied to me. I knew he was telling a lie. He insisted that he was telling the truth. He urged me to action, saying that Buddy Lawson had his eye on Diane. If I didn't ask her soon, Buddy Lawson would take her, and I would have to go dateless. Nearly every day in that 2-week period, I started to ask Diane if she would go to the party with me while we were putting up our instruments after orchestra. Nearly every day in that 2-week period, I would find some way not to ask Diane to attend the party with me. On the Tuesday of the second week, Fetzer left school early, leaving me to walk home by myself. About a block out of school, I found I was catching up with Sally. My thought was to keep up my normal walking pace, pass her, and that would be the end of it. My thought, my half-assed plan, almost worked, too. When I brushed by her, she insisted that I slow down and talk with her. I told her that my books were heavy, that the faster I walked to get home, the sooner I would be able to put them down and rest my arm. "I like you. You can slow down and talk to me," she insisted. She asked if I had plans to go to the 7th grade party. I told her yes, I'd be going. She wanted to know if I was taking anyone. I found a way to let that question slide, which led her to suggest that I could take her. I now had the opportunity to take up Bungard's suggestion. On the surface, Sally's invitation was tempting. Her circle of friends might help me shed my status as a nerd, but I also wondered if she was just trying to tempt me so that she could have a laugh with her circle of friends at my expense. Bungard may have put her up to it. Lately, he seemed to have joined Sally's circle. "I'll have to think about it," I told her. "Don't think too long," she told me. She thrust her chest out just a bit to emphasize her point. I picked up the pace on the walk home, leaving Sally behind. Later that day, I told Bungard that I asked her, but that she said no. I found out later that Bungard asked Sally to meet him at the party, but she turned him down, too. There were a few other guys in the class who dared to ask her out, but she had refused them, just like they refused Bungard. Although I didn't say a thing, almost everyone in the 7th grade knew that Sally invited me and that I had turned her down. Bungard told me that he wasn't fooled by what I told him earlier. He was jealous and told me that he wouldn't talk to me for a month. At the same time, Diane's response to my attempts to walk with her in the orchestra storage room let me know that she wasn't happy with me. That was a shame because Fetzer's encouragement was having an effect. I thought seriously about asking Diane to meet me at the party while we were having our square dancing session on Friday. I might have done it, too, had it not been for the fuss Sally made about my turning down her invitation on the walk home the previous Tuesday. Diane's response was to trade partners. She went to Fetcher to be his partner, leaving me with her friend Debbie as mine. For some reason, I thought that particular class lasted much longer than it usually did. When we finished orchestra that day, Fetcher pulled me aside. "We need to wait an extra 5 minutes before we walk home today," he told me in hushed tones. I tarried at my locker that afternoon before seeking out Fetcher by the exit door. He was patient. He waited the 5 minutes he had prescribed and then proceeded to walk with me in the usual route to his house. It wasn't long, less than 2 blocks later, before I discovered the method behind his madness. There in front of us were Diane and Debbie, chatting each other up with little regard to our impending presence. Fetcher slowed me down. "Diane expects you to ask her to meet you at the party," he explained. "I fixed it while we were in gym class." My feet were suddenly cold. "Are you sure?" I asked him. He nodded and picked up the pace. Within a minute, we had caught up with the girls. Within a minute after that, I took a leap of faith to ask Diane to meet me at the party. "It's not a date," I assured her. "It's just..." "I know," she smiled. "I've been trying to tell myself the same thing for the past couple of weeks." Fetcher and I spent the next 10 minutes arranging for what would be essentially a double date for the party. After the girls parted ways to go to their own neighborhoods, we resumed our own way. He revealed that he had asked Debbie to the party on Wednesday after my misadventure with Sally. Debbie's only condition was that I had to ask Diane as a double. The delay that afternoon and my invitation were planned in advance. The party was 2 weeks away. I told my mother I was definitely going. I didn't tell her that I was going to meet Diane. I didn't dare tell Doreen when I saw her at church on Sunday, even though her father treated both of us to a movie on Sunday afternoon. I had no idea what effect my impending meetup with Diane would mean to whatever happiness Doreen had had in being with me. She was a sixth grader living in the next town over from us. It was doubtful that she would ever run into Diane. I came to the realization on Sunday night that I now had 2 girlfriends. Things started to get a little tense in P.E. Sally suddenly became clumsy as my corner, occasionally stepping on one of my feet as I would go around the square. I thought it might be deliberate, a suspicion proven on the way to school one day. When Kramer and I passed her, she made some snide remark about my impending appointment with Diane. "You know she's a fake, right?" I could almost see that sneer on her face by the tone of her voice. She was only using you to get to Doug King. Doug King. If there was anyone in the seventh grade as vain as Sally, it was Doug. He was a short kid with a big mouth, one of the banes of my existence. The guys from my neighborhood would kid me about my nerdiness and life would go on. Doug hounded me almost constantly without remorse. "She's still as ugly as she was when you started school last year, Mike," she persisted. I fell back a step or two. I remember the braces and I remember the cat-eye glasses. I also remember that Diane made me feel good about myself. The braces and the glasses had been forgotten. "Mind your business," Kramer interrupted before I could get a word in edgewise. The next thing I knew, Sally and Kramer were in a shouting match about me, and my decision to meet with Diane at the party, I stopped the argument by pointing out if we stayed and fought much longer, we'd be late and we'd get a detention. "She really wanted to meet up with her, you know," Kramer told me as we went in the front door, barely beating the first morning bell. "You and Fetcher were the first to actually ask a girl for a meet-up. You put a lot of pressure on the rest of us." I hadn't realized what Kramer knew about my plan to meet with Diane. When I was getting ready to walk Diane back from school that afternoon, I asked her if it was true about Fetcher and me being the first to ask a girl to meet them at the party. "It's true," she confided. "It's all the girls will talk about while we're changing after P.E. For the next couple of days, I started to get strange looks from other seventh graders, the people I didn't really know. Eventually, Doug King came by my locker to taunt me, telling me that I was retarded for actually wanting to go to the party with a girl. The next thing I knew, I had Dougie pinned to a locker, letting him down only after telling him that I didn't appreciate the slur. For the rest of the time I attended Miller Hansen, Dougie didn't bother me again. The last 3 days before the party went by slowly. We found out that student council had made decorations and were in charge of putting them up in the cafeteria after school on Friday. We would be chaperoned by the teachers. One of them, Mr. Wills, the math teacher, would certainly show up with his camera to take pictures. We had already seen pictures from the ninth grade party held in the fall and the eighth grade party held just before Christmas, posted on a bulletin board outside of Mr. Wills' classroom. There is speculation as to who would be on his bulletin board after he took pictures at our party. I wasted a little time getting home the day of the party. My exit was timed so that I could avoid Sally and her circle of friends on the walk. Long legs and a quick cadence developed by attempting to keep up with my father stood me in good stead. For once, I arrived back home in less than 20 minutes. The party was going to be held from 7 till 9. My mother had me running from the time I had arrived at the house at 3:30 until a quarter till 7, when I walked to Kramer's house to catch a ride. I went through a full drill of bathing, getting dressed in freshly clean clothes, and being admonished to behave myself so that I can impress the girls, maybe even meet one who would suit my fancy. A couple of times I thought about telling my mother about my arrangement with Diane. Each time, though, I thought the better of it. An inquisition about Diane would ruin both of our evenings. "You boys got dates lined up?" Kramer's dad tried to start up a conversation as he was pulling his car out of the driveway. "I met Tommy's mother back in the day when we were only 11," he continued. I knocked her up with his sister before we turned 17. Not that I'm suggesting anything, you understand." It was known in our neighborhood that the elder Kramer was able to avoid the draft and a free trip to Korea because he had to support a family. He had connections with a local foundry and was able to land a good paying job before he finished high school. My parents would point out that Joe Kramer was an exception, that if I were to impregnate a girl before we got out of high school, I would not be quite as lucky as he was. Kramer's dad wouldn't shut up for the entire 10-minute trip to the front door of the school. We just smiled and tried to shut out his unwanted advice. We arrived to find a cafeteria decorated with streamers and posters depicting various characters from the Peanuts comic strip. Someone in one corner of the room was playing records in the vain hope that students would go out on the floor to dance. Classmates would filter in, usually in groups of 3 to 5, and would clump in little pods. The boys clumped on one side of the room, the girls on the other. There were snacks on the table in the back of the room. Before long, the pods started to migrate toward the table. The boys on one side, the girls on the other. 10 minutes after the party started, I finally spotted Diane. She was having an animated conversation with Debbie. Fetzer showed up next to me. "Are you ready?" he asked. Someone had to be the first to cross the invisible line. I looked across the line to see Diane looking directly toward me. She was dressed in a blue floral print dress which dared to expose that portion of her chest a few inches below the neck. Debbie was in a green version of the dress Diane was wearing. Aside from height, the only real difference between the two girls was the way that each of them filled out their dresses. Somehow or another, Diane had transitioned from being a little girl into a teenager. I wasn't the only one who noticed. From behind me, I heard several other remarks, most of them off-color, about her. Fetzer urged me forward. Diane started toward me. "See, you made it," she smiled. I had no idea what to do at this point. Do I shake her hand? Do I hug her? Do I give her a kiss? "Yeah, you too." All I could manage other than that was a nod. My hands hung loosely by my side. We decided to dance. The music dictated that we move quickly. There are other girls on the dance floor by this time, mostly dancing with other girls. Debbie and Fetcher followed our lead, along with a few of the other orchestra kids. Three songs later, almost everyone in the room had paired up, and we were having a good time. When most of the dance floor was filled, the disc jockey announced that he was going to change the pace for a song or two. Almost immediately, the floor cleared. While there were now a few boy-girl conversations on the sidelines, we were back to the previous arrangements of boys on one side and girls on the other. One song. Two songs. Someone has to be first. Why not us? Diane's question came toward the end of the second song. Because I don't know how to dance, I thought. On second thought, the chances of yet another slow song being played were quite small, so I went out on the dance floor with Diane. Almost immediately, I found out that I was wrong. The first notes of a recently released ballad oozed out of the speakers by the disc jockey's table. Diane's arm reached around me. She pulled me close to her, one arm on my back, the other arm reaching for one of my arms. I imitated her movements. Box step, she whispered, demonstrating with her feet what I should be doing with mine. The first line of the song finished. I looked up to see Debbie and Fetcher joining us on the dance floor. By the end of the second line, several more orchestra nerds had joined us. Look up and over there, Diane indicated to my left. A flash went off. Mr. Wills had the picture, which would go on his bulletin board in another week or two. I don't recall much of what happened for the rest of that evening after Mr. Wills took the picture of Diane and me. When it appeared on the bulletin board outside of his classroom, I took a good deal of ribbing from many of my classmates. One of them, I think it was Bungard, ratted me out to my mother. Amazingly, she said very little to me about my rendezvous, except to suggest that I buy Diane a corsage when I took her to the 8th grade party. For the rest of the 7th grade, I took the long route home so that I could spend time with Diane. She made me feel good about myself and taught me the one thing I didn't learn when we had the talk in 5th grade. Girls were interesting as people. They weren't just objects to covet. She was forgotten temporarily the following summer while I shuttled my attention between Fetzer and the guys in the neighborhood. I still had some childish endeavors which needed to be exhausted. When I was reunited with Diane back in the fall, our conversations in orchestra and our walks the way home resumed. On those rare occasions when I had to get home in a hurry, Fetzer would tease me the next day about his having to walk my girlfriend home from school. Diane and I had a laugh. Gender wasn't important. We were friends, that's all. At the time of the 8th grade party, I got news that our family would be moving to another town nearly 200 miles away. Diane and Fetzer organized my going-away party where we swore that we would never lose contact with each other. We kept that promise for 6 years by exchanging letters, gifts, and after we were trusted to drive, the occasional visit. I said goodbye to Diane for the last time in the summer of 74. It took me about a year after that to figure out that we each had separate paths to take in different directions. My mother asked whatever became of Diane at some point in the summer of 77. It hurt a little bit when I told her that I hadn't seen her for a few years. I knew that she was probably in graduate school by then, on her way to a doctorate. 5 years later, in 82, I had the notion and the opportunity to follow some of her footsteps by visiting the town where she attended college. Part of me hoped that I would run into her so that we could reminisce. My logical side told me that that was not going to happen. By the summer of 92, 25 years after our 7th grade party, my copy of the picture taken by Mr. Wills was lost in deference to my wife and our daughter. The image remains in my mind. I had brief contact with Fetcher a few years back, but other than that, I've had no contact with my youth other than to watch my children grow into and out of the roles Diane and I had when we were so young. We crossed many invisible lines in our lives, some of them willingly. Others we are dragged across while we're kicking and screaming. The people who help us cross some of those lines are people we will not soon forget. One of the hardest lines I had to cross came when I had realized that I no longer had Diane to help me across some of the lines I would inevitably encounter. We'd already crossed all of the lines in our lives which we would cross together. There would be new lines and new people who would ensure us that we would never have to cross alone. Next week, I'm going to probably go a chapter from a book that is in progress. It's a mystery at the library. And, expect a little surprise from our protagonist on this. Thank you for hanging on with me. In the meantime, don't take any nickels, and we'll see you out there. Be seeing you.